everyone. I'm Ryan.
And I'm Steve, and this is 60 Cycle Hum, the guitar buying, selling, trading, modding, fixing, breaking, reviewing, playing podcast. And today we have Mike Pusheen Adams joining us,
our good friend of the
show, and special guest Tawny Newsome.
Woo!
I don't know. Like, I know you from Space Force. I think Ryan and Mike know you from. Do you get know her from music? From
well,
Ryan, I think knows you from Yo, Is This Racist?
Yes.
Okay.
Mike these probably are all knows things. You from Lower Decks.
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
So we're just
keep all, going down the
all over the place. Four Lost Souls. I learned about Four Lost Souls last month, and Supergroup. Supergroup was a great one season. I'm waiting for season two. When's season two?
You know, I don't know that we might do one independently, but I don't think there's any future of doing it at Earwolf Stitcher, just because they're changing things there. And we loved all the people we worked with there, but it was super hard to produce. It was like a huge show. You know, Earwolf's usually like comedy shows, and you get in and out in an hour, and you book the studio for an hour. So it cost them so much money. We did not make any money. So it was, you know, like most musical pursuits. But it was really fun to do, and it was one of my favorite things to do. But I think if I'm going to do it again, I'm just going to, like, do it all myself. That's been my theme lately. I'm just going to do shit myself, you know?
That's a good way to go. It tends to work out. There's less people in the way to stop you when you just do stuff yourself. But then your own pocketbook gets in the way. Your own time and stuff. So, long story short of how we ended up doing what we're doing right now is I sat down and started watching Lower Decks, and I'd been thinking, like, I mean, we're a guitar podcast, but we've always shied away from doing interviews and stuff because I really don't want to go down the road of, like, oh, eventually we get to interview Slash, and then where do you go from there? Like, I really don't care about interviewing, like, big professional musicians. We're kind of like all on the hobby level, and all kind of like, you know, music a lot of times is, you know, our side hustle and things like that. And I've been thinking, I want to talk to entertainers that are also musicians as part of their side hustle or part of their, you know, their hobby or whatever. So I'm watching Lower Decks and very much enjoying it and thinking, like, man, Tawny kind of like lands directly in the middle of a bunch of Venn diagrams for us. Steve,
cool. So I should run this show is what you're saying?
Maybe. But Steve and I used to listen. We were both listening to Yo's This Racist back when it was just Andrew.
I was on Yo's This Racist.
Oh, were you? Were you question asker?
Yeah, did you call him? Sent in a question and Andrew shredded me. So at some point we will have you. Basically, that's we'll talk, maybe we'll talk about it later.
We often dive into, you know, topics of social issues and stuff like that on our guitar show for whatever reason. We often talk about Star Trek, which is why Mike is here. We love talking Trek with Mike. We know that you're a musician. And so it's just like all these connections, like I should just hit up Tawny and see if she'll get back. And you responded to me on Instagram. I can't believe it. So here we are. There's the story.
I did. You know, I mean, your DM was enticing. It was literally like, we're a guitar podcast, but we talk about Star Trek. And I was like, well, this is two of my interests. I like that.
That is Soundbrenner. That's not a sound.
Is what?
No, okay, never mind.
What are you talking about?
Oh, are you hearing the buzzsaw over
there? No, I'm looking at your giant watch and trying to figure out what it is.
Oh. It's a GPS watch.
Oh, okay.
You know.
It looks like there's a watch called a Soundbrenner that is it's a
metronome.
Metronome that you wear.
And
so instead vibrates. Of like click, 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 it just goes bzz, bzz, bzz.
People do weird things and they like sleep with them on and try to hard program, you know, like 120 beats per minute into their core of their being.
That sounds stressful. That sounds very stressful. But also, isn't a metronome just a mimic of a human heartbeat? So like, why do you got to wear another one?
Yeah. And what if you screw up your heartbeat? What if it works too good? Then you're dead.
Oh yeah.
Or you're.
Then you're on a different rhythm for your life.
Yeah. So anyways, when you got back to me, you're like, yeah, of course we can talk Trek eventually, but can we talk about my album first? So maybe we should start with that because you've got a new album coming out. I sent the link to Steve and Mike, and I'm pretty sure I know that Steve listened to it a couple times. I listened to it a couple times. Mike is nodding.
I listened to it twice yesterday and once this morning.
Good grief. Thank you. That's so nice.
It's so good.
It's pretty good. It's pretty damn good. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. We usually do an album review segment on the podcast. We have for the past year. Last night we reviewed Ghost. I don't know if you're familiar with them. And
no.
They're kind of like this faux Satanist band. like makeup and scary lyrics and stuff, but then it's kind of like cartoony and silly in a way. So my review for them was that solid intros, really great intros to all the songs, and then I was bored the rest of the time. I don't think I was bored for a second for your whole album. Like, it just, there's just a lot there. Like, every single song kind of takes you on this almost like ADD journey. I had a great time.
Oh, thank you. That's a great description. I love an ADD journey.
So I vaguely understand, like, the backstory is during COVID times, you guys piled into a trailer and recorded this thing. Is that kind of the gist of it?
Yeah. I mean, well, I lived in my house, but I have a trailer. So basically the spiel, the non-gross PR buzzy spiel is my like long time good friend Bethany Thomas. She's actually in For Lost Souls, a band you mentioned earlier. She's in For Lost Souls with me and John Langford from Mekons. And she and I have just known each other and been singing together forever, maybe like 12 or 13 years. We came up together in Chicago. We met doing like theater and, you know, acting stuff in Chicago. And then I think in like 2008, she was just like, hey, do you want to sing some backup in this band with me? There's like no pay, but like we sing a bunch of Rolling Stones covers and drink beer and whatever and hang out. So I joined her in that. And then because we have like a good blend, we're friends, and because we're like easy to hang with, I feel like we just became this like backing duo for hire for every like dude band
in Chicago that had like $100 to spare. So it was a really it wasn't ever like glamorous, but it also never was like horrible. It wasn't ever like a grind because we weren't ever trying to like promote our own thing, which can be a thing that burns out a lot of musicians. I feel like is like constantly trying to get people to come to the shows. So because we were always sort of piggybacking on dudes who were promoting their own shit, I feel like we've always had this urge to make our own thing, but we've both been pursuing acting. We've both had this entirely separate career, kind of like you were talking about, where music has been like our side hustle. So we fell hard into like the DIY scene when we joined John Langford. We went down to Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and did that record with him. I've sung on like 6 Langford records. We did an album with like an Aboriginal country singer that they call the Black Elvis. Like I've done so much weird shit.
That sounds amazing.
So yeah. So to cut to this album, it was finally like, you know, Bethany makes a living doing like huge musicals. She does like off-Broadway stuff. She does plays. I do a lot of TV and comedy stuff. And because of the pandemic, with all that stuff shutting down, like live theater, with TV production shutting down, we finally were like, oh shit, this is the first time we have time to just get together, the two of us. We don't need any dudes in the band. Like, we can just do it ourselves and make everything. And I have like a compound, like a doomsday prepper compound that I live on in Southern California. So I said, drive out here, like Mad Max style. You can live in this vintage trailer so that we can keep social distance. And let's just make a record. So for 3 weeks, just every day, like 8 hours a day in my little home studio, we just like looked at folks like you on YouTube to try and figure out how to mic drums and, you know, deal with phase issues and whatnot. Things I'd never really done before in any of my home recordings.
So yeah,
then we sent it to a proper mixer. I was like, okay, I captured everything, but we need someone to mix this so it's not a mess.
That's amazing that like this is the moment that you sat down and figured out how to like do your own recordings to a certain extent, like, and did it all. That's wild. You did a great job. I never would have guessed like, oh, this is their first shot recording stuff. That's wild.
Yeah, I mean, we'd spent so much time in studios, and like I've always been a good like, I think in another life I would have been like some kind of shitty like Ronnie Spector or like a Barry Gordy, like standing behind the glass with a cigar, like again, you know. I've always loved like directing studio sessions. I've always had a knack for that. I think I've learned from some of the best musicians, you know, in the world, just singing backup for them. Because what you realize is when you sing backup, a lot of lead dudes
don't have any real like mic technique or training. They just kind of go in there and do whatever. So for me to be like, oh, actually, like if you darken some of these consonants, your pitch will be better. You know, that those sort of things come really natural to me. So what I had to learn for this project was literally like, how do I mic drums? Like that was my kind of my Everest for this thing.
Last time I was in the studio, the way they were miking drums, I still don't understand it. Like it all just looks like magic to me. I don't know.
I know. And it really like, you can really get in the weeds. And I have such an obsessive personality that I was like trying to think about the types of genres we were going to be playing with on the record and what the best mic placements, given the mics that I had, which wasn't a ton. I have like two really nice expensive mics and then a bunch of just like workhorse, you know, basic ones. And I ended up going with like a really simple, like a really simple three mic setup. And then I'd like put another one on the snare every now and then. Nice. But yeah, it worked well. There were a few tracks in there that our mixer really had to work some magic on because they were just blown out or something. But yeah, it worked out.
Well, it's intentional, you know, it's like choosing to clip the mic, you know.
Yeah, it was intentional this time. Thank you. You definitely meant to do it.
It's a style, you know. You wouldn't get it. It's a style. Other people aren't gonna understand it.
Yeah, you have to really know music to get it.
You don't really capture the emotion of the drums if you're not clipping at least two of the mics. So,
thank you for seeing me.
Yeah.
So Ryan kind of mentioned this, and I don't know if it's. I guess it's kind of on there. Bits and pieces, but Ryan kind of mentioned that this album is I told, well, so okay, so my first take on listening through was I told Ryan, I was like, this is eight tracks, I want eight albums. Like I want each track to be the opening track on a different album. And Ryan's brain works very different from mine, and he goes, no, this is perfect. He goes, this is eight just songs that are just like take you on a musical journey all over the place, and it works. So I guess one of my thoughts going through is like, there are so many influences on here. Yeah. What was kind of like the songwriting process for that? Like, did you set out to be like, okay, this is going to be our 80s inspired track. This is going to be the R&B inspired track, or was it just whatever?
I heard a ton of like my 90s childhood in all the tracks.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I feel like the 90s never leaves me.
Yeah. But I was hearing, and it's nothing that was like, oh man, that sounds like this riff from that song or this harmony from that song. It was like, man, now I want to listen to Mother Love Bone. Now I want to listen to Harvey Danger. Now I want to listen to Owsley. Like it was like connecting like all these 90s dots for me, you know?
Oh, very cool. I like hearing what people hear in it because, you know, a lot of these started, I started with most of the demos, just, you know, me and a guitar, and I sent them to Bethany. But like, I think what I wanted to do, because Bethany released an album a couple months ago that's also incredible. Bethany Thomas, you should check it out. Sure. It's also on Bandcamp and everywhere. But it is even more, if you think this is like, it's a different album every song, that one is like, she gave no fucks about genre. She completely, one's doo-wop, one's like full drama rock. And it's very like well-produced. And we used our same mixer, Packy Lundholm, at Soundbolt Studios in Chicago. But, and he's like our lifelong friend and we've been in a million bands with him. But so what I really wanted to do with this project for her and I was strip the production back a little bit and really just capture like, okay, this was done in my literal garage that I converted to a studio. Everything just needs to feel a little more raw, and it kind of needs to feel, you know, even though my husband ended up playing a lot of the drum parts that I couldn't play, you know, I'm kind of like dictating to him, or like our guitarist, Patrick Martin, is playing guitar parts that I sketched out. And I'm like sitting there yelling at him about like how to strum it when like, I'm not I shouldn't be doing that. But it's because I heard things a certain way. So I had, you know, people who could execute them a little better. But what I didn't want was to suddenly like polish this up and make it super studio produced.
Right.
And you know, have it sound like things that she and I couldn't have played ourselves. Like the idea is most of these things we maybe could have played ourselves if we didn't. I did play all the keys on the record, which I really thought someone was going to come and replace. And then I was like, oh no, y'all are just leaving that? Okay. I mean, okay. But yeah, so in terms of your question about genres, like the influences came from, I mean, the fact that I've been singing with Langford, you know, if you do any listening to the Mekons, that like intersection of art punk with alt country to me is now like kind of a seamless genre. And I understand for a lot of people who haven't performed that music, it can feel quite separate. But to me, there's just such a fine, almost invisible line between like, yeah, kind of like alt folky stuff and punk. So that was the basis for the record. And then, yeah, I mean, the 90s garagey stuff. Mm-hmm. Don't know. Yeah.
I mean, speaking of like alt folky sort of stuff, like one of the artists that I was being reminded of a lot is David Lowery of Cracker and Camper Van Beethoven. Like, I felt like there was a lot of that kind of vibe floating through there. I don't know if you're familiar with him at all.
I'm familiar with Cracker, but I haven't listened in a long time. But okay. That's cool.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
Tawny, I heard Billy Joel in some of the vocal arrangements, and it stuck out to me. And all of a sudden, I felt like I was listening to some like River of Dreams era like vocal stuff. And I wanted to ask you specifically, like, what are your vocal instruments influences?
Instruments.
What vocal instrument do you use? What?
Mm-hmm. I use a scream. I use a yell. I use a, Billy Joel. That's interesting. I'm not as familiar with Billy Joel. I wonder if that's because what you know, when Bethany and I started singing together, the bands that we would sing in were usually like doing Rolling Stones or like Joe Cocker. I think of like the songs we've sung hundreds of times, it's like Delta Lady, My Father's Gun by Elton John. Space Captain by Joe Cocker again, Brown Sugar, like all those songs that you think like, let's get a couple of black ladies on the back of this. We're very much influenced by that, kind of whether we liked it or not. And then I also did a stint in a Talking Heads tribute band for a couple of years. They're incredible. They were called This Must Be the Band, and we recreated Stop Making Sense. They toured for years and years. I only joined them for like one, but that gave me a lot of like love of polyrhythms and layering, like on the song Juneteenth. The back half of it is basically just a love letter to Remain in Light, which is one of my favorite albums. But you know, when you listen to a lot of Talking Heads, I prefer the Stop Making Sense versions of so many of those songs because he recorded with other vocalists. And I love David Byrne, but I don't really need to hear like five David Byrnes harmonizing with himself on Once in a Lifetime. I'd rather hear like women who've been trained and, absolutely, you know, can add a different texture.
Right.
So that's probably what's going on. I don't know where Billy Joel fits into that, but
On, Mike, get it together. No, I think what's going on here is that you've made something that's very enjoyable to the three of us, at least. So hopefully everyone else likes it too.
Well, thank you.
And it's just to the point where it's become sort of like a Rorschach, where we're all hearing the things that we already like in it, you know? And it's not necessarily like a direct reference to anything, any part of it, but it's like, oh man, there's the musical thing that I like that happens in this other musical thing that I like. And I think it's a very successful album as far as, you know, being likable and being listenable and being entertaining. So, Thank you so much. I'm glad.
And it hits hard too.
Yeah, it hits really hard. I'm glad you made something that I didn't know was going to exist when I hit you up, that I can be excited about and actually enjoy. So thank you.
Yeah,
for that.
Thank you. I guess if you didn't like it, you would have just been like, no, we're good. We don't have to do the interview.
Aww. So this album is going to come out on October 9th. Is that going to come out on Bandcamp or what's your?
Yeah, you can pre-order on Bandcamp now. And that's, you know, what we prefer so that I can pay all of my lovely contributors. But it will also be out everywhere. So I like to say that, I like to say, you know, support the artists that you like on Bandcamp. And then that cleans your conscience for all the Spotify listening that you're going to be doing.
Yeah. And everything else. I mean, sometimes, you know, when I get my check from CD Baby for all my, you know, licensing or whatever, it comes every 2 years and it's $50. It's like, cool, thanks.
Congrats.
But then I know, right? I get something from them, which is more than most people. But then, you know, Bandcamp, every time someone buys an album, I get like $8 or something like that.
Yeah.
Bandcamp is really amazing. Fantastic. Everyone
and
should
he doesn't
be using
pay
Bandcamp.
The other people in his band.
Well, the deal when I've estimated that I've made back the cost of the album, then I'll start dividing it up.
Really? I mean, that's exactly what we're doing. And like the fact that we recorded it in my home, I think I bought one cable that I didn't already have.
Mm.
You know, like the overhead was extremely low. So that's why I'm kind of like, okay, well, if people buy it on Bandcamp, then I can pay my, you know, guitarist.
Totally.
And I mean, the drummer's my husband, so he's not going to make any money, but
he gets to hit drums. So that's his payment.
Yeah. He gets to hit drums with me standing over and being like, no, it's like this.
I've tried to do recordings with my wife and we've figured out it's not a good idea.
What does she play?
She has some experience playing, but she's mostly a singer. Like she's choir trained and stuff like that. So we just butt heads a little bit too much when we try to record things. So it's fun that you guys can record together. Steve and his wife record together as well. Mike, do you record with your wife? I don't know.
My wife and I, my wife's an actor and we do auditions together and we create things together. Sometimes I'll score a project that she's been working on. But yeah, I like to collaborate with her. She's a genius.
Yeah.
That's cool.
My wife and I were both graphic artists and illustrators. And so we'll collaborate on that. But music gets a little bit rougher.
It can be tough. Yeah, my husband Nate and I had a lot of conversations about like artistic discipline and creative, you know, work ethic in a way. That's not really the right word. But yeah, just like the fact that I've been fortunate enough to make a career a little bit in music, you know, in this super DIY way, but really just like in acting and on camera and stuff, I've cultivated a way to work, whether I know it or not, or whether I like it or not. And his is just different. He spent a long time in advertising and always played music as a hobby. So when we'd come together to try and work on things, to me, things that seem absolutely essential, he's like, what are you worrying about this for? You know, we just have to figure it out.
Right, right. Totally. Oh man, my mind just went blank. Does anyone else have any questions?
No, I'm thinking about that, like the recording mentality, because I know that's what my wife and I go through, and that we don't record much because I'm very much like, this is going on Facebook. Like the compression is going to wreck everything anyway. Who cares? You know, you're talking about clipping the mic earlier, Ryan. I'm like, this is going on YouTube. This is going on. This is going on a CD that like five people are going to listen to back when we used to do Christmas music.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
so Steve and I have,
but my wife is like, no, it all has to be good. And I'm like, no, I'm just going to clip everything and I'm going to send it. And I'm going to drive the guy who is mastering the album insane, but I don't care.
So yeah. Steve and I
mean,
have
that's
a
way to do it.
It's hard to gauge when to start talking with these things because I know there's a lag everywhere. Steve and I have a group of friends where years and years back, we were also running a all ages venue back at the time. So we had a lot of friend resources there, but we did a yearly kind of compilation of home recorded Christmas songs, whether they be covers or like original written songs and stuff like that. I think we did that like 4 or 5 years or something like that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. But it was a lot of fun. And I was kind of like remembering those times while listening to your album, just the idea of like getting together for quarantine to record an album with people that you know. So yeah, it was taking me back to that time, which was a bunch of fun.
Oh, I'm happy to bring back fond memories.
Yeah.
I have a question. May I ask a question, please?
Yes.
You, sir, in the back.
I've been called upon. Tawny, I noticed that you are a guitar and bass player as well. I saw a Mustang bass on your Instagram feed not too long ago.
My first one.
Can I ask you what brought you to the guitar? Like, how did you discover the musical instrument and what influences did you have?
Mike, you're outdoing me on my own guitar podcast.
I'm sorry.
What are you trying to make this on topic? Okay. Sorry
for Jesus.
It's funny because, you know, I think a few years ago, if someone had asked me to come on a guitar podcast, I think I would have been really self-conscious because I'm not a great guitar player. But now I really am happy with the way I treat that instrument because, to answer your question, the reason I came to it is because I wanted to write. I wanted to write songs and I wanted to support myself writing, you know, I wanted to support my own vocal lines and I didn't want to necessarily have to collaborate with someone until the way I like to collaborate with someone is to say, here's everything I've sketched out in a demo kind of poorly. You are better at this. So please play this part. And then, you know, and then we can have like a conversation about how it goes from there. But I really do like hear things pretty fully realized, but I haven't spent my life, you know, practicing and getting great at guitar. So when I first started, I think it's because I was singing with Langford. We had a little band called Skull Orchard. We put out two albums. We just put out an album called Here Be Monsters, which was really lush and weird. And I mean, Langford's this weird Welsh dude who's obsessed with like Americana. So, you know, all of his lyrics were very like complicated and stuff, but we had this really fantastic guitarist, my friend Jim Elkington, from a band called The Zinx. He used to play with Leticia Sadier from Stereolab a lot. And yeah, he's dope. Yeah. And that's like my shit. How about the 90s? Like Stereolab. I was a child when I got my driver's license putting a Stereolab CD into my Chevy Blazer, my 1980s.
It's so badass. Amazing.
No, it was not badass. All my friends were like, we're all listening to like top hit music of today, and you're listening to like this weird French lady. But yeah, so I think Jim was like, well, if you want to make music, like I'll just teach you to play guitar. I think we had like five or six lessons together, and he was like, and then I started writing little demos and stuff. And I think Jim was even like, this is so you to just learn all the chords and then just take off and start writing songs instead of like practicing the instrument.
Yeah. You know? That's kind of how I was starting out. Like I took like three lessons for guitar, and then I got frustrated that I wasn't being taught the songs I wanted to play. And I was like, I'm done. I'll just stay home and like figure out the ones I want to play instead. And you know, start writing things that I want to play instead. And I think that's so key. Like there's a certain type of personality that wants to be taught everything before they start. And then there's the people who just kind of fall in love with whatever instrument they pick up and they just do it, you know?
Yep. And I know that it doesn't have to be perfect because again, if the parts aren't usable, I have wonderful people in my life who can execute it. And I still feel like good about how I wrote it, you know? And then sometimes they just put the keys in that you played and you're like, this is somebody else could have done that a lot better.
Sometimes you want to capture that, you know, that raw kind of source material though. And if someone redoes it, it's overdoing it, you know, it's cleaning up the parts that have the character.
Yeah, that's right. Again, it was intentional. There's no mistakes on that album.
Yeah, exactly. It's perfect. It's a perfect creation that you did there.
We had that argument like 3 weeks ago. Somebody wanted us on the show to talk about like engineering mistakes that made it onto record. And that was Ryan. You just kept hitting that over and over again. They're like, they could have redone all of these mistakes. There are no recording mistakes.
They chose
anything that makes it onto a record was a choice.
I still stand by that.
I remember years ago, Fretboard Journal sent me to New York to interview Nels Klein. And something that he would always talk about was leaving some humanity on whatever he played on, and that mistakes didn't bother him when he, for instance, the solo on Wilco's Impossible Germany. It's one of the best like guitar songs I've ever heard. But in that solo, there are like one or two notes that he doesn't quite hit. He doesn't quite fully press the note down, and you can hear that. And he talked about having the option to do it again, but he said what he needed to. The statement was complete, and it felt like to him that if he had gone back and cleaned it up, that he would have lost something in translation. That perfection isn't always the best goal, and that has absolutely stuck with me over the years. And it's made me more comfortable as a musician as well. Like, yeah, you know, I would say that I'm very happy as well where I am as a musician, but I don't know. There's got to be a little bit of spontaneity and the space to not be the guitar god that you are in your head, because everybody has a voice and everybody has an expression. And I think if you're like focused on perfection, that voice just gets trimmed and trimmed and trimmed back. So it's really refreshing. Tawny, I love hearing you say that you're happy where you are and that you would have been maybe a little bit like afraid to do a guitar centered podcast in the past, because I mean, that's where a lot of us are. Like, even some of my favorite guitar players that I've also interviewed have said, like, oh, some nights I just don't feel, you know, all that great, or, you know, everybody's got a bad night. Like, that's an experience we can all share regardless of our skill level. And it's also important to remember that, like, I don't know, guitar's for everybody, and it's supposed to be fun. Like, it really, really doesn't matter at the end of the day if you're like shredding all the time. So that's wonderful to hear.
I'd prefer if people didn't shred all the time, honestly.
I would also prefer that.
I actually, I was feeling a little bit like self-conscious after you agreed to do this. I was sitting there thinking, like, I was pretty vague in what I said this show was. I wonder if she thinks this is going to be some sort of like classic rock boomer fest or something like that.
No, I could tell you guys were like on the right side of things. Okay. I mean, love me some classic rock, but no, I didn't think, I mean, I can be a little transparent. And literally what I said to you was like, because I think you were like, hey, let's talk about Star Trek. And I was like, if I say, yes, we're going to talk about Star Trek and CBS finds out, like, they have to approve everything.
Right, right.
But I'm like, if we come on here and talk music and then, like, Star Trek's part of my life, so sure, we can talk about, you know, so it's very much a calculated, like, yeah, I want to come on and talk about stuff. But yeah. I know. Oh, gosh.
Pulling back the curtain with Tawny.
You got to let them know about every single little thing. And then a lot of times they get weird and they say no because they're scared of things. And I'm just right. Like, these are normal. You seem like normal, nice people. So
we try to be.
Yeah.
Acting.
Should we segue into some Trek talk now that we're 35 minutes into this? Yes. Yes, she says. So I'm fully up on Lower Decks. I just watched episode 9 like 2 nights ago.
So good.
I don't think Steve's seen any of it unless something's changed, Steve.
I've watched a couple episodes here and there.
Okay.
I've watched 3 episodes.
I've very much enjoyed the whole series, but
yeah.
On episode 9 I legitimately started to cry laugh.
Oh yeah.
So good.
I love it.
And it was the ship scene. Just the circle, circling around the ship, and everyone just like, there it is. Like, and
the gratuitous shots of the ship.
It was so long and so perfect and so on point. Man, there's a lot of great moments in that episode. Like, I think so far 9 is my favorite of the season. Like,
oh, great.
Yeah.
I know. My mind changes all the time. I got all the rough cuts. Wait, did we say the name of it? Star Trek Lower Decks.
Yes.
I know I'll get in trouble if I don't say that. It's on CBS All Access. Don't yell at me. I just don't want to get an email from them. I'm living in fear, guys. So I saw all the rough cuts because we had to do a lot of additional voice recording after the lockdown. So we did a lot of it from home, which, I mean, since this is a guitar podcast, I can like kind of brag a little bit about my studio setup because, you know, a lot of actors have voiceover setups, but they might just be for like audition purposes. They're not necessarily like full setups to go to for public listening, you know, end product setups.
A lot of people just don't know how to use a mic without guidance either.
Truly.
Like a microphone is an instrument. And if you don't have practice with it, you are going to make big mistakes. So if you know how to use any mic, you are going to provide a better audio product. Just flat out.
And they were doing like a pretty intensive socially distanced. They were literally like sending engineers to people's houses to sit outside, I think in like a van, and they'd run cables in. And then the engineer would control the session while the actor was on like a Skype connection, trying to talk to our creator, our showrunner, Mike McMahon. It was a mess. So I was like, guys, I'm just going to do this myself. Just send me all the lines and I'll just like do it. And you can call me if you want, but like, I'll just run it because I have everything. And they were kind of like, that's cool. So we got so much more done. I think it would have taken weeks and weeks to do it the other way.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, so that's all to say that, I had a lot of favorite episodes because as I was watching the clips during that additional recording, a lot of the animation wasn't done. So now I think 8 and 9, seeing them fully animated, 8 and 9 are probably my favorite.
What happens in 8? I forget what happened in 8.
8 is the trial where we get a clip show. It's like a clip show of a a thing you haven't seen before, which I just love. I love that feeling of like making the audience catch up to what's going on.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Was that the one where John DeLancey shows up as Q? Was that that or seven? That was eight. Oh my God. I was shocked. I was like, my God, they got John DeLancey back? That's amazing.
I know. Yeah, they got him before the shutdown. So they actually got to meet him in the studio.
Oh, cool.
Oh, nice. Wow. Nice. What was I going to say? Oh, when I first heard there was going to be a new animated Star Trek series, the initial thing that popped in my head is like, oh, it's going to be kind of like in an Archer style, and it's just going to be kind of like cheap jokes about Kirk talking slow or something like that. And eventually it'll be its own thing, but it won't be really connected to Star Trek in the way that we want it to be. But I feel like this series, this show is like right on the money with the humor that actual Trek fans want versus like, oh, let's make something that's superficially Trek, but we'll try to appeal to a wider comedy audience. Like the jokes are so, and the writing is so focused on people who know way too much about Trek.
Right.
Like there's a lot of just deep fan servicing references in there that are still just solid, good jokes. And I just appreciate the whole effort.
Yeah. And jokes that you have to like, you have to know the series. Like I had a moment last night where I groaned at myself because I got a joke. I said, oh God. There was the line in the episode about the girlfriend. It was, he's like a Kirk Sunday with Trip Tucker sprinkles. And I went,
oh yeah,
I understood that.
I do not understand that. Thanks, Google.
Hey.
Oh, Jesus. It's because it's the series I haven't watched.
Yeah. You know, that's a good example of a joke that's like, if you get it, it's like a reference explosion in your brain. And even if you don't get it, like in the common, you know, zeitgeist, everyone has heard of Kirk. So, absolutely. And I think people know that he was kind of considered a heartthrob. Like, I think even if you're not a Trek fan, you're vaguely aware of that. So that's the genius of our writers, because they write these really layered jokes that for the most part work both ways. Like you get that we're talking about two hunky perfect guys.
Yeah.
Just because of the context. I think it's at its best when it's really able to hit that line, because I have friends who are like completely not into Star Trek, but they're watching it for me and they love it. And some things they're like, I didn't know what that meant, but everything going on was funny. So
I think it hits, you know, so I basically started, the episodes I watched were just this week, and I've been seeing kind of some of the, I'm in one or two Star Trek groups on Facebook. And some of the reaction is very, these nerd fandoms, people take things very personal, like, you know, with all the Star Wars stuff and like, oh, Rey's a Mary Sue and kill George Lucas for selling to Disney and whatever. And so, some of the initial reaction on Lower Decks, it was kind of like, oh, this is not serious and it's too funny and it's, they're, you know, it's trying to capitalize on Orville or whatever, and did it. And I'm watching, and I go like, no, like this makes sense. Like,
yeah,
this is a show. Gonna make a Star Trek reference because you know this,
yeah, of course.
This is a show if every character is Ensign Kim. Like, what does Ensign Kim do when he's not bitching about not getting a promotion? When he's not going out with the Delaney sisters or whatever. Yeah, he's not on the bridge, he's a nightmare.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, Mike McMahon, our creator, is such a fan. You know, he got the job because he ran that parody Twitter account, TNG Season 8.
I had no idea he was involved. I love that account. Oh my God.
That's like literally where he came from. Like he'd been working in animation forever. He'd been working in, he worked on Rick and Morty, and he has a show on Hulu called Solar Opposites right now, but he's a huge Trek fan. And so he did this parody Twitter account where he would write fake A and B stories. So it'd be like, you know, Picard and Crusher go down to an alien planet and then time runs backwards. Meanwhile, Geordi gets his head stuck in a lamp or something. So Kurtzman and Secret Hideout and stuff brought him in to talk about like, what would it look like to do a comedy? What would it look like to do an animated comedy? And he just pitched them. He pitched them on the show, I think, saying like, I want to do a show about the people who have to put the yellow cartridge in the replicator so that a banana comes out. I just thought that was so cute.
Oh, man.
No, it really nails that vibe. And you know, it nails. I think it's in episode 9. It concludes with the revelation that the
spoilers.
Is this a spoiler?
Not that revelation. The series.
The other revelation. Pardon me. I thought we were talking about the one revelation.
But you find out the one revelation in the first episode, right? Like, don't you?
Yeah. No, the revelation I was talking about is that the warp core is cool.
Okay. The warp core. Yeah.
Like, and
we working, all knew that, baby.
Working in, so I work in biotech, and I go through this whenever we hire a fresh college graduate. And they come into the lab. I work in this space where I'm like, this is like the dumbest. I'm just so over it. I've been looking at this stuff for years, and it's just a tool. To me, it's just a tool. It's a way to do my job. But we bring in these like fresh college graduates that we hire, or we bring on an intern to like wash dishes, and they come in the lab and it's like, oh my gosh, that spins.
A real protein incubator. I can't believe it.
And I'm just
okay, we're doing this.
All right, it's dog time.
And so it's like that moment like hit something visceral for me. I'm like, I know these people. They work for me, but I know these people.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. I like that. Yeah, I wonder what that would be for my career for acting. I think it's like sometimes when you meet the like background actors who come on and they're just like, I get to like stand behind you in the shot. So like the camera might see me. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there. I'm like, my feet hurt. It's hot in here. I'm wearing 4 pairs of Spanx. I want to fucking kill myself. so I have to be like, oh, you're right. Like, this is magic. This is a cool thing that I get to do. Yeah. So I need to be more like those kids that work for you.
one of the fun concepts in one of the episodes is, it's called flex time, right? Or it's a different
buffer time.
That's it. I don't think Steve caught that episode yet, but, that was brilliant. I was thinking about that for a few days afterwards, and I'm self-employed and I was still like, yeah, I need more buffer time in my life.
You got to build it in for yourself, especially when you're your own boss.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So outside of being, you know, well, here's what I wanted to ask before I side tangent into this. You don't have to answer if it'll get you in trouble with CBS, but do you think that do you think Lower Decks is canon?
Yes, it is. It officially is. Fans can disagree if they want, but like at the end of the day, the people who decide what's canon are the people who write the checks, like people with the name Star Trek on the building. So yeah, it's canon. And you know how I know it's definitely canon, and it's not like some secret thing where the production company is going like, yeah, they think they're canon, but they're over here in this little wing, is that there are people, there's like, I guess they're cartographers. There are people whose jobs it is to update maps of anything established in the Star Trek world so that if something appears on a series, there's a map of Cardassia at this certain time, or there's a map of the Klingon homeworld. And anytime we reference a new world or create a world or go somewhere within an existing world, the people who work on Picard, the map people, they update the maps in case Picard ever references that area. So it's nothing that you've ever like called out, but the fact that it's in the fabric, it's like, yeah, like us or not, we're treated as seriously as the rest of it.
And one of the reasons I wanted to ask if it was canon is because in one of the earlier episodes, I forget which one, your character plays electric guitar, and now we know Dread. Electric guitar does exist in the Next Generation timeline.
It's a flying V, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not just, you know, violin rehearsals. Or like,
well, Data played classical, so, you know, it's in there. And we had a first season of TNG had that weird country dude who's like, I need me a guitar. Can you replicate me one of those? Wow, this is the best guitar I ever done played. And it's the worst guitar you've ever seen, by the way. But
we had jazz music at like Vic Fontaine's in the holodeck and stuff. So I guess this is the first like electric guitar. And I'll tell you a little bit of trivia before I jump out of here. But this has been super fun, by the way. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for joining us.
The in the original, what's it called? In the animatic. So like before they fully illustrate it and everything, they weren't sure what music they were going to get. So Mike McMahon put Enter Sandman in and Tendi and I were singing it. And I was like, oh my God, do you think we're going to get the rights to this? He was like, I don't know, like we have money. Maybe we can get through. I'm like, yeah, blah, blah. And then of course, like the most litigious band in the world, there's no way they would let us use it. There's no way. So our composer, Chris Westlake, just wrote something, you know, metal-esque.
Nice.
For that moment.
It was great.
Yeah. But yeah. I love talking about track and I love talking about music. So thank you for giving me an opportunity to do both of those things.
Of course. Thank you for responding to my shot in the dark over Instagram. I was honestly surprised when you got back to me.
Yeah, you know, it's not every day that people want you to talk about music when you do comedy. Like, people just want your talk. Like, just like, what's it like working with Steve Carell? Like, I get no more of those questions in my life, I'm so happy. He's great, by the way.
There goes my next question.
let me cross that one off. To work with John Malkovich, but you know.
Malkovich is a delightful lunatic who texts me K-pop videos every now and then. Wow.
So I guess if we're wrapping up, we're promoting the album for sure.
Yes.
Anything else you want to promote, Tawny?
No, I think you guys have been so great. Yeah, the album, you can go to tawnyandbethany.com. That takes you straight to our Bandcamp for pre-order. Okay. We just did another run of vinyl because we sold out of our vinyl pre-order. But yeah, check out Star Trek Lower Decks on CBS All Access every Thursday. The last episode is next week.
Yeah.
Or at the time of recording next week. I don't know when this will come out.
I got a little sad when I saw the little trailer at the end of episode 9. I was like, season finale. That's going to be it, huh? 10 episodes. And then, you know, the way animation works, you know, someday there'll be another season.
We're working fast on season 2. Hopefully we can get it to you in a quicker turnaround time.
Yeah.
So anyways, this has been fantastic. Thanks for doing this again, Tawny. If you ever want to join us randomly, feel free to hit me up and we'll throw you in the mix. Like you want to rant about something musical, Trek or otherwise. We have a smaller audience than you're used to, but you're more than welcome here anytime you want.
There are no small audiences. None.
You haven't
especially
been
not when everything's over Zoom.
All right. Cool. Bye, everyone. Thanks for watching and listening.
Guys.
Bye. Thank you so much.
Stay grounded. That's our catchphrase. Come down and help. I'm way over here, but I can see you struggling, honey. Can I come down and help? It sure looks heavy. Can I come down and give you a hand? I see that you're straining and I don't want you to drop it. Can I come down and give you my hand? What can I do to help? You're way up there, but I can see you waving to me. What can I do to help? It must be heavy. How can I make the day better for you? I'll gather materials, anything you need, you got it. What can I do to give you a hand?
see me struggling, honey, carrying something heavy. Can you help?
Can you come hold me when I need a friend?
We'll handle it carefully. Now is the worst time to drop it. Can you come down and give me your hand? Till you can, I come.